This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
Welcome back, folks, to The Enemies List. I'm your host, Rick Wilson, and today we have my friend Benji Backer. Benji is the author of a new book called The Conservative Environmentalist, Common Sense Solutions for a Sustainable Future. And I want to say why this is so important, because Benji understands something. As the executive chairman of the American Conservation Coalition, he understands that there are two dead-end approaches right now. There's the unlimited drill everything, burn everything MAGA approach. And there's the freeze in the dark approach, which I'm summarizing that not in his words, but in my own. And he makes a case that there is a big element of the traditional pre-MAGA conservative movement that really was deeply dedicated to environmentalism and conservationism. And I'm glad to welcome him to the show today, because I think this is an important topic where folks do need to come together across the political spectrum to really focus on. And so, Benji, welcome to the show, and tell us about the book.
Rick, it's great to be here, and truly appreciate your willingness to have me on. And you're right, this book it's an important time for it, because we're sitting at a crossroads of inaction on environmental issues for probably going on two decades. And this issue used to be an issue where Republicans worked with Democrats, as you alluded to. Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush have some of the best environmental legacies in history. And that's not to say they have a monopoly over the issue. Republicans, they worked with Democrats on those sorts of reforms. Now it is Green New Deal versus denial. And neither one of those are helpful for our planet. Neither one of those are helpful for our economy. Neither one of those are helpful for our national security. And unlike an issue like immigration or guns or other issues that are incredibly polarizing, understandably so, this is an issue that affects all of us pretty equally. Mm-hmm. We all have an equal stake in it. It affects our neighborhoods. It affects our quality of life. It affects our economy. It's so much bigger than just the environment. And if we don't pursue a realistic approach that I outline in the book, which I'm really proud of, and I think it's kind of one of the first pieces and resources that gives that alternative, then we're all going to be worse off. And if we don't fix the divide on the issue, we will never solve it.
I think that's right. I think there's a degree to which, and again, in this day and age, you have to bifurcate pre-Trump Republicans who, listen, I worked for George Herbert Walker Bush 41, and I didn't work, it wasn't my department, but the administration overall worked on things like acid rain and other climate stuff. Maybe not enough for some people, maybe not enough for some folks, but in the era of Trump, it was drill it, use it, burn it. And there was an abandonment, I think, of even like the sort of nodding acquaintance to conservationism that, you know, and you mentioned some of the presidents who'd been involved in it. I mean, going back to Teddy Roosevelt, who had a fundamentally different approach of conservation and preservation in this country, which I, you know, since I'm old, I don't remember it, but I don't remember Roosevelt directly, but I do understand that it did shape a lot of my beliefs as a conservative growing up, that we have things to preserve and conserve. So, you know, I think that's where a lot of folks have yet to grapple with. It's like, there aren't two sides in this equation. There's sort of one and a half sides. And I think that's what's valuable about this book, is that you're introducing the prospect for conservatives to understand why why we have to take a different approach than straight denial on things like climate change and things like preservation.
In the book, early on, I talk about how kind of Tucker Carlson and Donald Trump promote this idea that climate change is just a hoax perpetuated by the Chinese. Climate change is a hoax. And that message is not something, A, that they know anything about from an actual substance perspective.
Oh, yeah, of course.
The reason that they're saying it is because they're just trying to play defense against the left's bad ideas without having to do any of the work of coming up with an alternative idea. So what I mean by that is rural America and conservative America has real fears about – real understandable fears about the proposals that the left has put out there, things that would really hurt their livelihoods. And so when Donald Trump says that, it comes across as, hey, at least somebody – isn't buying into that approach and what that approach that's going to come from my livelihoods. And what I'm saying in the book is that no, for rural Americans, for conservative Americans, there's a path, and for the rest of America, there's a path that is good for the economy, that is good for rural communities, that is good for mm-hmm. our energy production. And so you can dislike the left's approach on this without denying the very existence of these issues. And right. Donald Trump took us back 10 to 15 to 20 years on the narrative, even worse than that, because the narrative was better in those years prior. So, you know, there's a lot of undoing that has to happen. But while Donald Trump's narrative has skewed the GOP towards denial, the AOCs and the Bernie Sanders of the world have also skewed the left towards radical action. And America is left thinking, what do I even do about this topic?
So folks may or may not know this. My family has a big ag background, citrus, cattle, soy, cotton, corn, blah, blah, blah. And while they're not radical Trumpers, there is this concern that's like that a lot of folks in the ag community truly believe that people in Washington want to regulate them out of existence. And I think that that has been something that has been underscored or undercounted by Democrats as a factor in where some of this rural, I don't want to say radical, well, I will say it, rural radicalization has sort of emerged from, where they don't seem to, they can't understand why they don't get a hearing from people when the people that they're trying to communicate to have essentially been told, hey, they're going to close your farm down. We're going to be, you know,
yeah, they're
the villains, right? They're the bad cops. And what are you going to do about it? I think that's something that has really been underpriced by Democrats and by progressives in their communications on things like climate, in a way that would be helpful if they could sort of clarify what they're really after, more than just letting the cliches that some of their people believe in, but the vast majority, I think, do not.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many cliches that they say. I mean, ban fossil fuels and cows and farts are bad. Cow farts are bad. I mean, there's all these kind of things that they're talking about, and capitalism bad. You know, they're blocking traffic, throwing soup at paintings. That is a very small percentage of people on the left, to your point, but that's what comes across in the narrative, and it comes across as if everyone is trying to tell rural America how to live their lives. The reality, and this is where, like, there's truth in the importance of solving this issue quickly. So that's where like the radical left gets it right. Where the radical right gets it right there's also some truth in the fact that America doing more energy production, more farming, more manufacturing is actually good for the environment. There more American energy independence and kind of like, you know, without it having the stereotype that it does, an America first mentality on doing things here actually is good for the environment. Our farming practices in America actually reduce carbon more than it emits. We sequester more carbon on our farming land than what we emit. And so that's not true for other countries.
Correct.
Our natural gas, as I talk about in the book, is cleaner than any other country. Our mining practices are cleaner than any other country. And so in a world where we need farming, in a world where we need energy, in a world where we need mining, we need to be doing it in the United States. That doesn't mean that there's not a serious problem that we also have to address on the environmental side too, and that those things could actually work in tandem.
Right. And I think one thing that I would, and I have encouraged some friends on the left to talk about more, is one thing America is really shockingly good at is innovation. And there seems to be a perception sometimes that the left doesn't quite understand how to overcome, that their solution is to, again, it's the freeze in the dark solution.
Regulate.
It's the regulate everybody, everything, all the time solution. And really, that idea that we can't innovate in some ways on this, and that we can't apply our robust national genius to many of these things for fixing problems, I think that is something that has left a lot of people on the right and the center sort of disappointed. I mean, it's like we're on the cusp of a lot of developments in this country, including things like fusion, which I know it's always a few years away, but it is much closer now. You know, we don't seem to have a willingness to try to communicate on the fact that America is good at a lot of these things. We could be doing things that are fixes technologically, both on the production side and the mitigation side, like carbon capture and things like that. And it's like, I think a lot of the times people hear, like they hear the left basically saying, nah, we can't do that. That doesn't matter. Freeze in the dark. And I think it's something that folks on the left and the center left should be really thinking about a lot more than they are right now.
Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo. Modern management made simple.
Totally agree. And I think that actually boils down to where I went in the book about kind of how we pursue solar and wind. And for a while, the left saw that as the panacea, the silver bullet to solving environmental issues. And it sounded really nice. You know, we have wind, we have sun. Why not use it to power our homes? Like it kind of intuitively makes sense. But when you dive a little bit deeper, there are some serious trade-offs and issues with reliability and affordability, and you know, 24/7 power is important. So there are these realities that only technology can fix. Only technology can solve these complex challenges. And to have the right saying that oil and gas is the only way forward, and the left saying solar and wind are the only way forward, picking those winners and losers is completely ignoring the fact that we are good at technology and we are good at innovation, and that we don't know what the future holds for energy or the environment. We just know what we have right now. We have to deal with those current realities while also hoping for really, really cool ideas to come out in the future. I mean, the hybrid vehicle, for example, which has been, you know, heralded as an environmental, you know, huge environmental win for people mostly on the left, actually came out of a free market competition that different car manufacturers in Japan were having in the 1990s. At the same time that the U.S. government was trying to regulate that same technology, Japan created it on its own because they knew that that's what consumers wanted. We cannot underestimate the power of technology and innovation in this country or in other countries, because that's what's going to solve this. It's not going to be regulation.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
As a person who believes that there are technological solutions to a lot of things, not everything, but a lot of things, I mean, there are areas that some folks say, like, the climate is the most urgent emergency, but we won't look at any technology that could be like geoengineering or nuclear or any of that. And I think that's a big mistake. I think that makes it less, I think it makes their arguments broadly less credible and effective, because there is a degree to which it's not all going to be solved by windmills, folks. It's not all going to be solved, you know, in ways that, you know, are this sort of kumbaya, it's going to all be easy to do, we're all going to just get together and make it happen out of good wishes and great karma. There are hard problems, and they require technical solutions. And I did say this in my book facetiously, but I said, you know, at some point, if you're really serious about this, somebody's going to have to nuke a volcano. You know, the idea of climate engineering scares the hell out of people, but it wouldn't take much sulfur dioxide in the upper atmosphere to cool the Earth off by 2C. And it's absolutely mortifying to a lot of people, but you know, there are fixes out there, folks, that human ingenuity is pretty good at developing.
I mean, humans are really good at two things: screwing things up and fixing those screw-ups.
Right.
as a fellow human being, I'm really good at screwing things up, but you can fix it. And, you know, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be one thing. And, you know, especially when you're taught, like, think about how complex the border is, right? It is a really complex problem. It is one area of this country. There's only a small set of solutions that really could be pursued at this point, and it is pretty easily identifiable. The environmental challenges are different in literally every square inch of this world, because somebody in Nebraska is feeling an environmental issue so much differently than somebody in South Florida, which is so much different than somebody living in Japan. So, like, this is not an easy issue, folks. Like, this is not simple. And to pretend like there's some easy solution is just wrong. I mean, you look at, I talk about this in the book, but how many, it takes 3 million solar panels to replace a nuclear reactor in terms of power. And it takes all the space, all of the mining, all of the unreliability to do that. So that's not to say that solar is bad or that we shouldn't pursue solar. It's just to say, if you're trying to pursue this Green New Deal strategy and replace every energy source in the world with wind and solar, you basically are blanketing the entire Earth with solar panels, and the sun doesn't shine all day. So we need to stop oversimplifying this issue and start working towards really cool, innovative solutions. And whether that's hydrogen-powered cars or geothermal energy or even something as simple as plugging the orphaned wells that there are at, you know, on abandoned,
that are kicking out a lot of methane, right?
Right. On natural gas plants, old natural gas plants, 70% of our methane in the United States comes from natural gas. If you could reduce just the orphaned wells, you would reduce emissions significantly in this country. Like, there are so many answers at our fingertips and so many answers that technology will create. But I firmly believe, and I talk about this a lot in the book, that the government is not the place that we should be relying on. And I think that's where environmentalism needs to kind of shift.
Well, look, I think there are a lot of people who believe that only the government can solve the problem, but there are also a lot of incentives outside of government that will drive faster innovation. Because look, I mean, I had a conversation about this the other day with someone who said, oh, well, you know, the government is going to be able to regulate AI. I'm like, no, it won't. We haven't regulated browser cookies, for God's sake. And we're 30 years into the internet.
Rick, I don't even know what a browser cookie is. They always tell me to clear my cookies. And I'm like, I don't know what that means, but I'm
right,
going to do it.
But that's the thing. It's like the government has such a problem with moving at the speed of technology and the necessary speed of innovation.
They stifle innovation. It takes 12 years to have the government allow us to build a clean energy project in the United States. 12 years to be allowed to do that.
Right. And I mean, as you write in the book, if these problems are as urgent as we agree they are, you can't just have, you know, there's no national or transnational body alone that is going to solve this issue. They're just not capable in the time frame we need of developing, deploying a regulatory structure that would actually make sense in the course of all this.
Exactly. And the government also doesn't know how to take care of local communities better than the local communities know how to take care of their community. Like, and I think that that's where this issue starts to really expose itself, is on a topic like forest fires, where a state like Montana might have a horrible forest fire start, either naturally or because someone's car was on fire or whatever in the summer. And because the forest fire is touching public land, the state and local communities aren't allowed to fight the forest fire because it's not their jurisdiction, even though it's their backyard. And that's the sort of example where it's like the federal government, I would love to see the federal government as the last resort when it comes to the environment. I'm not saying that it's not a resort. It's not a place that we should go at some points with certain parts of the dialogue. But I would rather rely on the market first, then local communities, then local governments, and then up to the state and federal government instead of relying on the federal government first, because there is no one-size-fits-all approach. And it does affect everyone so much differently. And each community knows how to take care of their backyards best.
Right, right, right. So tell us a little bit more about how you came to find yourself in this interesting niche of being a conservative environmentalist. Because, like I said, my generation grew up thinking about Teddy Roosevelt in that position. And frankly, although people find this so weird today, it's like Richard Nixon really was an environmentalist, folks. I know it seems weird to people to say those words, but he really was. So where did it come from with you? What inspired you not only that led you to this position as a young conservative, but also to write this book, to make this appeal to, left and right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And it comes down to something that I think most people can resonate with, which is that everyone has a reason, either multiple memories or a memory that they connect to when they think of why they care about nature. For me, it's sitting on a dock with my grandpa at a lake house, that a little cabin that they owned in northern Wisconsin. And just the feeling the peacefulness of nature, when you're in places like that, you don't care about what political ideology my grandpa was, and I didn't care about what political ideology the people who kayaked by us were. These are good human beings in nature enjoying what we all think is incredibly special. And it's so much bigger than partisan politics. So when I was a conservative activist in middle school and high school and college, when we first started, seeing each other, there was an obvious distrust that I had of my own side in solving an issue that's very important to me. And young people care a lot about the environment. They don't want the Green New Deal and they don't want denial. They don't want it even to be partisan. And I have this pipe dream of making nature nonpartisan again, because like you said, even Richard Nixon was one of the prominent environmentalists, even though he was an ardent Republican and even pretty partisan for his time, obviously. So there was a frustration from my end where it's like, wait, I consider myself an environmentalist and a conservative, and everyone that I talk to tells me that those things are at odds. I don't think they're at odds. And so I'm trying to, with this book and through my work, show that conservative environmentalism is inherently conservative. Environmentalism is inherently liberal. Environmentalism is inherently about all of us. You can be conservative, liberal, or anything in between, and you are an environmentalist if you care deeply about this and want results. And I'm going to launch a campaign soon around kind of making nature nonpartisan again, and in showing how diverse of voices actually believe in the same principles when it comes to environmental protection, because I think most people would be shocked that there is more alignment there than we think. And over the past 7 years of building a grassroots movement, the only grassroots movement on the right on the environment, I have seen time and time and again how this could be one of those issues that starts to bring politics back to the ground level again and making us feel like there's actually some hope out there.
Well, Benji, I congratulate you on the book, and I wish you all the best on it. And tell people where they can find you on social media and how they can follow you.
Well, I really appreciate it, and this is kind of the first book in this space, so I would appreciate any support. You can go on Amazon or any book retailer and search The Conservative Environmentalist and order it there. You can find me on social media at Benji Backer and BenjiBacker.com, which will have all the book information very soon. We'll be live, and that's probably the best. And then my organization is at ACC_national if you're looking for kind of the approach that we take and you want to join the movement. But I really appreciate you having me on. You've got an important voice that spans the political spectrum, and that's what we need more of on this issue and a whole lot of other ones.
All right. Well, Benji Backer, thank you so much for coming on the Enemies List today, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hopefully on again soon. Thanks so much.
Well, folks, it's not a surprise for you to find Donald John Trump on our Enemies List. Over the weekend, I'm recording this on Monday the 8th, over the weekend, Donald Trump, after he supposedly raised $50 million, which he didn't, it was only about 22 to 25. I'll tell you why later. They double counted. It's BS. But I wanted to jump in because Donald went on social media, on his dollar store social media platform, Truth Social, which is crashing in the stock market right now. And once again, engaged in his not so elliptical, not so clever threats against the judges handling his civil and criminal trials. He was asking, what will it take for someone to step in on this? He wasn't talking about some sort of judicial action. He was talking about somebody coming out and sweeping the chessboard clean by attacking or killing one of the judges or their families. This is exactly what he's doing. If you don't believe me, think it through. He is desperate to reset the board. He is a guy who has relied on the threat of violence and on January 6th of actual violence in the past. This is why, if you're not paying attention to what he's really trying to do, you need to open your damn eyes, because Donald Trump is, as always, at the pinnacle of the Enemies List.
Thanks again for listening to the Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.